What is up, my spooky bitches? Welcome back to another episode of the Hello Sydney podcast, a podcast for horror lovers where we discuss any and all things horror. And it's me, your host, Sydney. What is up, everybody? What's everybody been up to? How's everybody's day? Anything new? Anything exciting? Any new horror movies you guys have watched lately? I feel like I'm so behind on releases this year. Like, I still have not seen Late Night with the Devil. I still have not seen the first Omen, despite hearing everybody say this is like the best and scariest movie of the year. TikTok, I love it, but sometimes it does make me feel super behind because people are constantly like, when are you going to put up a review of this? When are you going to put up a review of this? When I get to it, okay? When I get to it. I'm a little behind. I unfortunately do have a life and like a job outside of TikTok. So I'm working on it, guys. Be patient with me. But anything else you guys have seen that you would recommend? Because I have one. I got this screener the other day of this movie that came out of Spain, and it's called The Coffee Table. And I get screeners all the time, right? Like, I don't get paid to watch those. I just get people being like, oh, like, hey, we have a screener if you want to check it out. And if you like it, do a review. Cool. I get them all the time. It's not that I don't always like them, but a lot of the times I don't like them enough to do a review on them. However, this one, absolutely fucking insane. I'm actually going to be putting up a full review of it on TikTok probably today or tomorrow. But holy shit, guys. And when I say today or tomorrow, by the way, you're going to hear this on Wednesday the 17th. I'm filming this on Monday the 15th. So I'm probably putting that up today or tomorrow. But let me tell you guys about this fucking movie. Holy shit. I have not seen something so bleak and numbing since Speak No Evil in 2022. Honestly, when I got the email about this movie and I read the little blurb about it, it's like a couple's life is flipped upside down when they buy this coffee table. My first thought is I'm thinking it's going to be something supernatural. And even the way this movie opened, it made it seem like it was going to be something supernatural, but it is not. It is something entirely real and like a real human tragedy. And it is so devastating. And just like the way that it portrays grief. And again, it's just so bleak. And like this is one of those endings that you'll sit there wondering why the fuck you even watch this movie, why you're even a horror fan in the first place, because why do you feel emotions like this after watching a movie? You know, like, it's literally one of those. The ending is so devastating. There's nothing satisfying about it. And you'll sit there completely numb. So keep an eye out for that on my TikTok, because I'm going to be putting up a full review about it. And I'll also say like where you can rent it and stream it, because it came out in 2022, but it's just having its North American release now. And I think it's like May 14th or something like that. It's going to be hitting some sites for rent, like Amazon, Vudu, etc. Today, though, we're going to be talking about something else. And I think this is a long anticipated episode because, I mean, for myself personally, honestly, because this is, of all the horror movies I've ever seen in my life, and of course, by now you guys know I'm a seasoned horror watcher. I've seen over thousands of movies. This movie in particular is my second favorite horror movie of all time, only second to Psycho, 1960, which is my favorite. But this movie I also truly believe to be the scariest movie ever made, and it's The Exorcist from 1973. And in addition to scariest, I also think it is like the most iconic movie ever made. Again, maybe second to Psycho. But the two of those have always been in constant competition for me, because this movie truly changed the game. And I don't think anything has traumatized an entire generation of people and continues to traumatize people to this day like The Exorcist has. And I think it still holds up. And I think the stuff in it is still incredibly shocking, even for audiences today, never mind in 1973. So we're obviously going to do a whole breakdown of the movie today. I'm going to talk about a little bit like behind the scenes stuff that went on the set of this movie, because it really is fucking insane, honestly. Like, the shit that they were able to get away with in the 70s is like literally illegal today. Like, they could never do this shit today. But at the same time, I think that's why they got such iconic movies, which might be a little bit sadistic to say, but we'll get more into that later. So let us just get right into it, okay? So The Exorcist opens up and we see a shot of this brick house. And it ends up being the house in which all of the events of this movie take place, which of course we don't really know at this point, but we get a shot of the house and then the title card drops. That's it. It's a black screen and it's the red words saying The Exorcist. So directed by William Friedkin, based on the novel by William Peter Blatty, The Exorcist. And I think when this title card showed, people in 1973 had no fucking idea what they were about to be in store for and what was about to happen to them. And then we jump to a very different environment. And people often talk about this movie and they're like, the beginning of this movie is just so like out side of what the rest of this movie is going to be, but there's a purpose to it. Obviously, there's going to be a purpose to it. But next we cut to this like desert scene. All right. And we hear like this chanting, and obviously it's in a different language, so we don't know what they're saying. And we see a bunch of people excavating. Okay. So they're just digging. And all of a sudden we see this kid running, and we kind of follow this one specific kid. And he gets to this like older white dude. And in a different language, he says, they found something at the base of the mountain. And the white dude gets up and follows the kid. So he gets to the base of this mountain and he finds this like medallion or like a coin, whatever you want to call it. And it has like a saint on it. And in addition to that, he finds this like little statuette thing. And as he kind of brushes it off, it has this demonic looking face. And he looks like he's kind of distraught. He looks kind of terrified. We really see that in the next shot, which is him sitting at a restaurant and he's literally shaking. He like goes to pick up his drink and he brings it to his mouth and he's shaking and he's looking at this coin. He's looking at the statue. And then he meets up with this other dude who calls him father. So now we understand that this white man is a priest. And the father, the priest, who we end up knowing as Father Marin. Father Marin looks at this other guy and just says, there's something I must do. And he starts walking down the street. And it turns out this is in Iraq. Okay. So they're in Iraq and he's walking down the street. And again, he just seems like completely distraught. He's like distracted. He almost gets hit by a horse and buggy and he just looks not well. So he then arrives at this other location, which is like, it's like ruins. It looks like it's almost some sort of like archaeological dig or some ruins. And he gets there and these two guys like point a gun at him, but then they see who it is and they drop them. So obviously they know Father Marin. And Father Marin continues walking and he comes across this large statue. And the face of this statue is the same face that we saw in this little tiny statue that he had found. And as he looks at the statue, there's like these dogs that are fighting that are super aggressive. And the statue just has this like evil, evil face on it. And Father Marin just stares at it. And you can tell that this is not good. We are not well. And we kind of see just like a standoff between Father Marin staring at the statue with the sun going down. And then all of a sudden we cut to a new location. And this location is Georgetown, Washington, D.C. So we're in Georgetown and we meet this woman. This woman ends up being Chris McNeil. She's going to be one of our main characters here. And she's in bed and she's like reading a script and making notes. And then all of a sudden she hears these noises. So she gets out of bed. She puts her robe on. She goes into the hallway. And it sounds like whatever noises these are, it's like banging. It sounds like it's coming from the attic. So she kind of looks up above her. And then she goes into the room next door and she checks on her daughter. So she goes to check on her daughter. Her daughter's asleep. The window is open. And you can tell it's freezing just by the way Chris kind of like covers herself up with her robe. So she goes and closes the window and then she tucks her daughter in because again, it's freezing and the daughter is completely uncovered. So Chris goes downstairs where she's greeted by her, they call them like servants in this movie. It's the 70s. But she has like a maid and like an assistant, a butler, I guess you could call them. And they greet her. They're like, good morning, Mrs. McNeil. And they're cooking breakfast. And she looks at Carl, who's I guess the butler, if we want to call him that. And she's like, we have rats in the attic. And he's kind of going back and forth with her. He's like, no, we can't have rats. And she's like, I just heard them. We have rats in the attic. Like, I need you to put traps up there. And then we learn that Miss McNeil, Chris, is an actress because the next scene that we see is a movie set. And this is taking place, I want to say it's at Georgetown University, but it's taking place on campus. And we keep seeing this priest in the crowd and he has like dark hair and very like strong facial features. And Chris notices him too. But she ends up like acting during the scene. She goes in, cue Chris, whatever. She's reading her script and all that jazz. So Chris films again. Obviously, she's an actress and they wrap for the day. And there's a man waiting for her in a car. And she's just like, you know what? I think I'm going to walk home today. And he says, OK. And she's walking home. And this is when we get the iconic sound of tubular bells. Okay, I'll play it at the end. But if you don't know the Exorcist theme, then you're not living. Okay, the theme song alone will strike fear into most people's souls. It's just so chilling and you just like associate it with this movie. But again, this is where we get the first sound of that is this scene. So we see Chris walking home. It's obviously fall. It's Halloween because people are like kids are dressed up running around. We get this beautiful shot of these two nuns walking and their habits are like billowing behind them. It's like really beautifully eerie in a weird way. So Chris continues walking and she also sees the priest that we already saw on the set of the movie. Okay, the priest with the dark hair and the strong features. So she kind of just looks at him, pauses for a moment, and then continues walking anyway. So Chris gets home and she greets her friend slash also Reagan's tutor, babysitter, whatever you want to call her, Sharon. And she gets home and she says hi to Sharon, and Sharon's like, oh, you got an invitation for dinner at the White House, telling Chris this. So Chris is obviously a big fucking deal. And then Chris says hi to her daughter Reagan. So obviously we saw that she had a daughter earlier, but this is the first time we actually see her interacting with Reagan. She's asking her like what you did to her today. Reagan's telling her about her day, and then she's like talking about horses, like, oh, mother, can we please get a horse when we get home, like whatever. They're having fun, they're laughing, like Chris chases her out and like in a just a fun place way, and you can tell the two of them have a very loving relationship. And then we cut to the priest that we've already seen a couple times earlier, and this ends up being Father Damien Karras, and we see him waiting for the subway, and then we see him kind of walking through what's like a rundown neighborhood. There's like hooligans, children, I mean, there's hooligans like jumping on cars and just like causing a ruckus and whatnot. So he's walking through this kind of rundown neighborhood, and he ends up going into a house, and he gets into this house, and there's pictures of him as like a wrestler and like some trophies and stuff of his. So obviously we know that this is where he grew up or somebody he knows lives here. And he goes into the next room and he sees his mother. And his mother speaks to him in Greek, and she calls him Dimmy. Oh, hi, Dimmy. Hi, Dimmy. So they're speaking in Greek, and he's like wrapping her leg up for her because obviously she had some sort of injury. And he's saying like, oh, I really want to take you to like a home. He doesn't use those words, but I want to take you somewhere you're going to be safe. Like, I don't like the thought of you like coming up these stairs like this and going out. And she's like, no, this is my home. I'm staying here. Like, fuck off, pretty much. So we see that she ends up falling asleep, and Damien leaves her some money on her dresser, turns her radio off, and he leaves. Next, we get a shot back at Chris and Reagan's, and we see them in the basement, and Reagan's like playing arts and crafts, and she's playing ping pong. They don't live in this house. That's revealed to us. This is just somewhere that they're staying while Chris is filming the movie that she's currently on. So they're actually like, their regular home is somewhere else, and they're just staying here for the duration of Chris's filming. Chris is down in the basement with Reagan again. She's playing with a bunch of different things, and then Chris finds this Ouija board. So fucking red flag. Obviously we know that this obviously is not going to be good. So she finds this Ouija board and she asks Reagan, like, what is this? And Reagan's like, oh, I found it in the closet and I've been playing with it. Again, red fucking flag. So Chris is like, oh, let me see how it works. And she goes to put her hand on the planchette and it just like flies away from her. And nobody really fucking questions it, which is like the crazy thing to me. And Reagan just tells her, oh, Captain Howdy said you can't play. Or like, Captain Howdy says no. And Chris is like, who the fuck is Captain Howdy? Again, she says it with a lot less like urgency than that, like as if she doesn't care, which is wild. But she's like, who's that? And Reagan's like, oh, he gives me all the answers. Like when I ask him basically questions, like he's the one that answers on the Ouija board. Like, Captain Howdy, is my mom pretty? Oh, he doesn't want to answer. Like, that's not Captain Howdy. That's not nice. Like, whatever. So Chris just thinks she's fucking around and that she's like talking to an imaginary friend or whatever, and kind of brushes it off and continues on. So then Chris goes to tuck Reagan in that night, and they're talking about what they're going to do for Reagan's birthday, which obviously is coming up. Sounds like it's coming up. And again, just from this like exchange, you can tell that they have a very close, loving relationship. And then Reagan brings up Mr. Dennings and is like, oh, is Mr. Dennings going to come? Whatever. Burke. Turns out his name is Burke Dennings. And Reagan's like, don't you like him like you like daddy? And Chris is like, no, Burke and I are just friends. Like, don't worry about it. And we once again cut to Father Karras, Damien. And this time he's sitting in a bar and he's drinking and he's talking to another priest. And he's just telling him, I need reassignment. I need out. I'm unfit. And I think I've lost my faith. So obviously you can tell that Damien is under some sort of stress. He's kind of questioning his whole like life, basically, like questioning his whole priesthood. And he just seems really stressed about it. And the priest does not agree to reassign him. And it doesn't sound like he's going to agree to reassign him. So then we cut back to Reagan and Chris. And this time we have Chris angrily calling Reagan's father because he didn't call her on her birthday. So he's a fucking scumbag. They don't say that. I'm saying that. But she keeps trying to get through to him. And this is the 70s again, where you have to call the operator. So now she's yelling at the operator and the dude just doesn't fucking answer, doesn't call. So then Chris gets a call in the middle of the night, or what seems like the middle of the night, because it's still dark out. And it turns out it sounds like it's from like the director or something, because he's like, I need you to look at this on page whatever of the script. And Chris turns her light on and goes to get the script. And she notices that Reagan's in her bed. Which she ain't go to bed with Reagan there, but Reagan's in her bed. And she's like, honey, why are you in here? And Reagan just goes, my bed was shaking. And once again, Chris just moves on as if this is fucking nothing. But then she starts hearing shit in the attic again. Okay, so on top of her daughter saying her bed was shaking and the whole Ouija board scenario, now she's hearing shit in the attic again. So she goes up to the attic and she sees all the mouse traps that Carl put up there still filled with food. So Carl was indeed right. There's no rat. There's no mice, whatever. And then Carl shows up and startles her. And he's like, see, no rats. And she's like, yeah, fucking great, Carl. Thanks. I see that. We get a shot of another priest. And this particular priest walks into the church. And all of a sudden, he stops in his tracks. And he looks absolutely in shock. And we see the reason he's in shock. And it's because we see a shot of the Virgin Mary statue, obviously, and she is completely defaced. She has like fake boobs on her and she is just like, it's complete blasphemy, and the priest is in absolute shock. And then they kind of just brush past that. And the next shot we get is of Reagan getting some blood work, and he's asking like, can you feel this? And she just says, I don't feel anything. And all of a sudden she's been a sweet, really sweet, kind girl from what we've seen up until this point. And all of a sudden, she's just acting really like aggressive and odd. So it's kind of a really fast switch. And she's acting really aggressively towards the doctor, like she's getting mad at him. And she's just acting very odd from what we've already seen of her characteristically. But then the doctor goes in to speak with Chris as Chris is waiting in his office. And the doctor tells Chris that she's showing all symptoms of the disorder of the nerves. It's what they called it in the 70s. And Chris asks like, oh, these lies that she's been telling, is that a part of it? Thinking like the lies are like, oh, her bed shaking or whatever's happening. She thinks she's lying about that. And then the doctor asks Chris, does she swear? And she's like, no, she doesn't. Absolutely not. And he's like, well, she had quite a vocabulary in there. And Chris is like, what the fuck are you talking about? And the doctor said, like, Chris is like, can you give me an example? And like, the doctor's hesitant, but then he tells Chris, well, she told me to keep my fingers away from her goddamn cunt. Imagine that coming out of a fucking 12-year-old's mouth, okay? Because I don't think I mentioned that yet, but Reagan McNeil is supposed to be 12 years old. And Linda Blair, even at the time, I think was 13 while filming this movie. Her 14th birthday happened while she was on set. So, like, just imagine that. So obviously Chris is like shocked and she starts crying. So we leave them and we once again jump back to Father Karras. And this time Father Karras is seemingly in a rush, and he's talking to who ends up being his uncle, the brother of his mother. And they're going to a hospital because it turns out that his mother was admitted because they found her, like her brother found her unwell in her apartment. And it's like weird because it seems more of like a mental institution than it does a hospital. So he's going in to see his mother and he has like these older patients grabbing at him. It just seems like they're kind of fucking insane. And then he gets to his mother's bed and she's like tied to the bed. She's restrained to the bed. She has like handcuffs, not handcuffs, but you know, like what you would see in a mental facility. She's like strapped down to the bed and she just looks at him and she's like, why'd you do this to me, Dimmy? And it's like really sad. This always makes me really sad. She's like, why? Why'd you put me here? Why'd you do this to me, Dimmy? And he's like trying to explain like, mom, I'm going to get you out of here. But she's really not hearing it. She's fucking pissed to be here. So then he's leaving and he's kind of fighting with his uncle and he's like, why would you put her here? And the uncle's like, what do you want to do? Put her in a private hospital? Do you have money for that? And obviously Damien doesn't because he's a fucking priest. So they don't really have another option. We cut back to Chris and this time we see that she's having this like very lavish party in her home. And it's obviously with some people from the set of the movie because we see the director there. We see another priest there, Father Dyer. Chris asks Father Dyer, who is this priest that I keep seeing? And she explains like the one with the dark hair. And he says, that's Father Karras. He's actually our psychiatric counselor. And he's like, he tells Chris, he's like, you know, it's really unfortunate. His mother actually died last night. And then he said she was dead a couple days before they found her, which I'm not going to lie to you guys. This is honestly the part that I never got, because like, how was she dead a couple days before they found her if she was in this mental hospital? So I don't know if that was just like a slip up on terms of like in terms of the script, or if that was fully intentional. And I say intentional because I'll get to this later, but there's a moment where William Friedkin, the director, actually wanted to purposely make it seem like Karis might have been having a hallucination, like the demon might be making him hallucinate, which I'll get to that later. But I don't know if that's the case here or, again, if it was just an accidental mistake in the script. And I've never been able to clarify that. I've never seen anything about that. So if anybody has, please let me know. Anyway, so obviously Chris hears that and she's like, oh my gosh, that's awful, whatever. They go back to the party and somebody's playing piano. They're all singing. Everybody's having a grand old time. And then all of a sudden Reagan comes downstairs and she's just standing there. And Chris looks at her and she's like, Reagan? And they stop playing piano and everybody goes silent. And she just looks at one of the men and she goes, you're going to die up there. And then just fucking starts peeing. Just pees on the rug. So Chris is obviously like distraught and is like, I'm so sorry. She's been sick, and goes to put her to bed. And the moment she walks away, all of a sudden she hears something coming from the room and she walks back in and the bed is violently shaking and Reagan's on the bed and she's screaming. She's like, mother, mother, like violently, violently shaking. So now Chris obviously sees that she was not lying because she thought Reagan was lying about her bed shaking, but this could not possibly be a lie. A little later on, Father Dyer ends up going to see Father Karis and he's trying to kind of comfort him, but Karis is drinking and he's just saying how he's guilty. And then we see him have this dream of his mother and he like is across the street and he's waving at her and she's standing at the top of the stairs that go down to a subway and he's just like violently waving at her. And then we see an image of this necklace falling and the necklace is the same exact medallion that we saw Father Marin with in the beginning. So cut back to Reagan again and she's once again in a doctor's office and this time she's just like a lot more violent and aggressive. She's screaming, I don't want it. And she spits in the doctor's face and says, you fucking bastard. Which again, this is just a complete 180 from the sweet little girl that we saw in the beginning of this movie. And once again, keep in mind, this is a 12-year-old, okay? We get a shot of Karis doing this service, leading a service, and there's like no emotion in his eyes. It looks like he's not really into it. It's almost like he's not even believing the words that are coming out of his mouth. You can just tell. And then we cut back to Chris, and this time she's crying in the doctor's office because she's talking to the doctor. They're trying to find out what's wrong with her daughter, obviously. And the doctor tells her, we found a brain lesion in Reagan's temporal lobe, and this could cause convulsions and hallucinations. So that explains why the bed was shaking, blah, blah, blah. And Chris is like, that's not why the fucking bed was shaking. Like, I saw it. There's no way that a convulsion could have caused that. And the doctor just says to Chris, the problem isn't her bed. It's her brain. Fuck you, idiot. Then they're doing some more tests, and this time this is the gross scene, and this actually is the scene that it's said that most people pass out during. So when you hear about people passing out during this movie, it's really not even the I'm sure it is also the possession scene, but this is the scene that one theater at least was saying this is the moment where a lot of people are passing out, because they're doing more tests on Reagan and they take a needle and they put it in her throat and there's a bunch of blood spurting out, and it is like really cringy and uncomfortable, especially if you don't like blood. Now this is also the scene, so my third episode I did on this podcast was an episode on cursed films, and I talked about this during this because The Exorcist is one of those films that they consider to be cursed, and I'll get into some of that later. But one of the reasons is one of the individuals in this scene that I just mentioned, he was an actual like x-ray technician. His name was Paul Bateson, and he was in this movie simply because he worked at the place or at the medical center where it was shot, and they wanted somebody who like genuinely knew what they were doing to make it seem like the procedure was legit. So they ended up like casting this guy as this, you know, kind of extra role in this movie. 2 years after this movie came out, however, in 1979, Paul Bateson was convicted of murder of a film critic, and he ended up being sentenced to 20 years in prison. Part of the reason why people say that's like part of why this film is cursed is because everybody had described Paul as being a quiet, nice, you know, typical individual. And then 3 years after this movie was filmed, a body's found in his apartment. And people believed that the devil got into him after making this movie, and that's what caused him to kill this individual, despite the fact that he actually turned himself in and said it was just a crime of passion. Because I think, or it's kind of suspected, nobody really knows, think that this was like a previous girlfriend or something, and things just went wrong and he snapped. Either way, that is pretty eerie to think of this guy being on camera when he just did that a few years later. But regardless, so they do these procedures, and then the doctor's kind of looking at these scans of Reagan's brain. And the next shot we get is the doctor being called to Chris's house. And they're like rushing. We hear screaming coming from upstairs. They run the doctor upstairs and we see Reagan flailing on the bed. Okay. And when I say flailing, she's being like flopped around and she's screaming. It's burning. She's flopping. Her eyes all of a sudden go white, like her eyes roll to the back of her head. And this like guttural growl comes out of this girl and her throat swells up. And then all of a sudden she gets up and she looks at the doctor and looks at her mother and says, "The sow is mine." However, she says it not in a little 12-year-old girl voice. She says this in a deep, guttural, demonic ass fucking voice. And then she starts screaming, "Fuck me," to the men. This little 12-year-old girl screaming repeatedly, fuck me, to the men, to the doctor. And then we see her be slapped by an unseen force with enough force that it like leaves fingerprints on her cheek. And eventually the doctors are able to restrain her and they very heavily sedate her to get her to stop. But this is the first time we really witness that something else has taken over Reagan. And now this scene is another reason why people often refer to this movie as being cursed. And if you know anything about this movie, I'm sure you've heard the stories of this before, but Linda Blair, again, at 13 years old, was actually very severely hurt during this scene. She was actually strapped to a harness in the bed, and that's how they were able to get those like sequences of her flailing around the way she did, because like if you've seen the movie, it looks unnatural, it looks inhuman, and it's because she was strapped into a device that was doing it. And at one point the device malfunctioned and this poor little girl fractured her lower spine during the filming, and that's actually what they kept in the movie. So when she's screaming, she's actually screaming out for help and they think that she's acting, so they continue to fucking flail her around. So she had already fractured her lower spine. They continue to flail her around, and what you see in the movie is her real cries of pain. This always makes me really sad because there's a behind the scene like shot of this happening and you see them yell cut and she just keeps crying, and like this actually makes me emotional because I feel bad. Ellen Burstyn runs to her. Mama Ellen Burstyn runs to her and like comforts her. And it's just so sad to think about because Linda Blair went through so much making this movie. And again, like I think people forget that she was literally 13 years old. And like if I was 13 and I was like surrounded by all these men who are like aggressively like flailing me around with this harness, not really caring about my well-being, and like my spine gets fractured, I'm calling out for my mom. I'm absolutely crying out for my mom. And mom wasn't there. So Ellen to the rescue. So yes, poor Linda. She actually was injured during the scene. And that is what we see in the film. So back to the scene, they sedate her. And Chris is obviously like completely distraught. And she's asking the doctors, like, how could she fly off the bed like that? And they're like, oh, well, pathological states can induce exaggerated physical states, blah, blah, blah. And Chris is like, shut the fuck up. Like, obviously, this is not like, did you see what happened in there? Like, be so fucking for real right now. That's me paraphrasing, but that's basically what she meant. And once again, they're like, oh, it's her temporal lobe. And Chris is like, did you see her or not? Like, what's next? And they're like, oh, well, what's next is we're just going to do some more tests. That's what they do. The next scene is Reagan getting more tests, and she's clearly in distress. She continues to be in distress. And then we hear the doctor telling Chris her x-rays are normal. Everything's normal. And then they're asking, like, do you keep any drugs in your house? And Chris is like, no, of course I don't keep any drugs in my house. Like, she's not on drugs. And the doctor, obviously, again, like, seeing that all of her tests are normal and obviously she's not on drugs, is like, well, I think it's time that you start looking for a psychiatrist. Then we see Chris driving home once again. She's obviously, like, very bothered by this, as anybody would be if your daughter was acting like an absolute fucking savage. And she drives by a bunch, like, she drives by a crowd of people. And we see, like, police sirens and police cars and this, like, big crowd of people. And she kind of just drives past it and she goes home. But when she gets home, she's like calling out for Sharon or anybody and nobody's answering her. And she's in the kitchen and the lights are flickering. And actually, this is the first time where we see the subliminal shot of who we call Pazuzu. So Pazuzu is never called Pazuzu in the movie, or I guess we can call him Captain Howdy because that's what Reagan calls him. So there will be moments in this movie where it's just like a quick flash of the face and it's almost like, did I really just see what I think I just saw? But we see the flash for the first time over Chris's shoulder in the kitchen as the lights flicker, and it's just like whited out face. And little fun fact here, that was actually one of like the trial runs for what they wanted Reagan to look like as a demon, which I'm so glad they didn't do that, because the way that they actually made her look is so much more terrifying than the white Pazuzu face. But either way, the white Pazuzu face is terrifying when you just see it in a brief flash of light. So again, nobody's answering her. She goes upstairs and once again, the window's open and it's freezing. And this time we can see that it's freezing because we see Chris's breath, and Reagan once again is uncovered. So she goes to cover Reagan, and then she hears Sharon come in downstairs. So she goes downstairs and she's like, how could you leave her alone? And Sharon's like, I didn't leave her alone. Like, Burke happened to come over and like I had her stay with, like had him stay with her while I went out to go get her medication. I'm so sorry. Then Chris is like, oh, fucking Burke. Like, he really just came here and then left my daughter alone, whatever. And then there's a doorbell. The doorbell rings and she answers it. It's another guy that we had seen earlier from the party. I think it's like the assistant director on the film, somebody that's working on the film that Chris is in. And he's like, oh, I assume you heard the news. And they're like, what are you talking about? And he's like, Burke's dead. He fell down the top of the steps and he broke his neck outside. So Burke Dennings is fucking dead. Burke Dennings is the director of the film that Chris is working on, by the way. So Burke is fucking dead. So Chris is distraught. She's crying. And then all of a sudden she turns around to go talk to Sharon. But instead of looking at Sharon, she looks at the stairs, because this is where we get the iconic spider crawl scene. Because she looks over and she sees Reagan in a backbend crawling down the stairs. And Reagan opens her mouth and it's just blood dripping out. This is one of the most iconic moments of the whole film, and this actually wasn't even in the original cut. Okay, so in 1973, when this movie came out and it was traumatizing people, they didn't even see this scene. So this was performed by a stunt double, and she was a contortionist. Her name was Ann Miles, and this scene in particular was filmed in November 1972. Now, to do this scene, she was strapped to a harness, and there was wires above the staircase, and that's how she was able to kind of, you know, crawl down the stairs in a backbend the way that she did. Now, in the final cut of this movie, William Friedkin actually deleted the scene. And the reason that he deleted it was because he said that there was no way to hide the wires from plain view. Because again, this is the 70s and she was attached to a harness, and they had tried to like paint them like white and black and kind of use the light to hide them, but ultimately it didn't work. So they had to get rid of the scene. 30 years later, however, Friedkin ended up changing his mind and put the scene back in the movie for the extended version that was released in 2000, because he was able to digitally remove the wires, which I think was a great idea, because personally, like, I think when people think The Exorcist, this is one of like the iconic scenes that you think of. So I really can't imagine it without it. So Chris takes the doctor's advice and ends up getting a psychiatrist. So the next scene we see is Reagan sitting in a chair, and she's almost catatonic, and she's just like staring off into the distance. And the psychiatrist starts asking her questions, and she's responding, but like there's no emotion in her response. It's just very monotone. And again, she's just looking into the distance. He's like, is your name Reagan? Yes. Is there someone inside you? Sometimes. She goes, the shrink goes, who is it? I don't know. Is it Captain Howdy? I don't know. Super eerie the way she's responding. And then all of a sudden, there's a picture of Reagan on the fireplace, and it just like flies off the fireplace. And as that happens, we start to hear this like guttural growl coming from inside this little girl. And the shrink asks, who are you? And Reagan just jumps on him, just attacks him. And this scene was actually this was inspired by my other favorite horror movie. Spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Psycho, I mean, it's been out since 1960, so you have no excuse, but there is a scene where the Detective Arbogast goes up the stairs and he's attacked by Norman Bates, and he does that like fall backwards, and it's almost in like a slow motion type thing. So it's the same thing here. So Reagan attacks the shrink and he kind of does this slow motion fall backwards, and that shot was inspired by the shot in Psycho. Anyway, they end up restraining Reagan. She's screaming. It's utter fucking chaos. And now we jump back to Karis, and Karis is jogging and he's approached by William Kinderman, homicide. Turns out he's a homicide detective and he's investigating the death of Burke Dennings, and he explains the whole death of Burke Dennings to Father Karis, and he asks Father Karis, what do you know of witchcraft? And Father Karis, and like they're talking about the desecration of the church. So again, that was a very brief scene from earlier, but they bring it up again now. And Father Karis is like, do you think the desecration in the church has to do with witchcraft? So they're kind of talking about that. And then Kinderman's like, all right, I'm going to tell you something about Burke's death that was kind of left out. And what I'm about to tell you is that Burke Dennings was found with his head turned completely around facing backwards, okay? And the fact that this could have happened by him falling down the stairs is possible, but it's unlikely. So the detective tells Karis, like, I think he was killed by a full-grown man and then thrown out the window to make it look like he fell down the stairs and died. And I think the killer and the desecrator are one and the same. And then he asks Karis to see a movie with him. It's this kind of funny little scene. He's like, oh, I have tickets. You want to go see the movie? And Karis asks him what movie and who's in it. And then he's like, I seen it. And we move on. So we move on back to Reagan. And this time we see her restrained to a bed, and we see that there are cuts developing on her face. Okay, it's not the complete, it's not the extent that it is when the possession scene comes, and by the like the iconic scenes and shots that we see of that terrifying demonic face, but you can see that they're starting to develop. There's a bunch of doctors sitting at a round table with Chris, and they're talking about how Reagan's having delusions, that her body has been invaded. They're talking about it again as a disorder. And they ask Chris, do you have any religious beliefs? And Chris says no. And she's like, they're like, what about your daughter? And she's like, no, like, why are you asking? And one of the doctors says, have you ever heard of exorcism? And explains to Chris that an exorcism is when a priest tries to drive out an invading spirit. So Chris doesn't really pay any mind to it. Like, again, she says they're not really religious, and she goes home. And when she goes home, she's checking on Reagan, and she finds that there's a crucifix underneath her pillow. And she asks Carl, like, did you put this crucifix in Reagan's room? And he says no. And then she asks, like, the other maid and Sharon, like, did you put this in Reagan's room? Everybody says no. Everybody denies it. And spoiler alert, not really spoiler alert, we never find out who put the thing in Reagan's bedroom. And as she's asking this, she gets a knock on the door. And when she goes to answer, it turns out to be Detective Kinderman. And he starts asking questions about Burke. And Chris explains that he came to visit. He was like taking care of her daughter, apparently. And Kinderman's like, it's just kind of weird that he came to visit, stays for 20 minutes, and then leaves a sick girl alone by herself. And then he explains to Chris, like, I'm just saying the fall wouldn't do what we found that it did, apparently. Like, it wouldn't have done how we found him. And he, like, he explained to Karis, is like, I think that he was killed by a powerful man, and it's probable that he was killed and then pushed from Reagan's window. And he's asking, like, they refer to the people as servants. He's like, do your servants have any visitors? Like, were you expecting any packages? Wondering if Reagan said anything or if she remembered anything, to which Chris is like, no, she hasn't said anything. I don't think she remembers anything. She's been very sick. And then there's this cute little scene where the detective asks Chris for her autograph for his daughter, and she's like, yeah, sure, what's her name? And he just looks at her and he's like, I lied, it's for me. Big fan. So he leaves, and now Chris is panicking. You can tell that she just looks panicked because she's really questioning, like, what the fuck happened to Burke, right? And then all of a sudden, she starts hearing Reagan yelling from upstairs. So she starts running up the stairs. She's running towards Reagan. And she gets up to Reagan's room, and there's just objects flying all over the room. And this is where we get the scene. And I think this is a scene I can imagine people passing out at this, because people in the 70s were not prepared for this. And I think this is something that even people in fucking 2024 are not prepared for. I don't think we could handle seeing this on film in this day and age. And obviously, I'm talking about the scene where they walk in, or Chris walks in on Reagan masturbating with a crucifix. This obviously is the most controversial scene of this whole movie. And once again, keep in mind, Linda Blair is 13 years old playing a 12-year-old girl while she's filming this movie. And as she's doing this, she's saying, let Jesus fuck you. Okay. So, I mean, if you're wondering why people say this movie's cursed, obviously you can imagine that it stemmed from people who don't fucking like the Lord's name being taken in vain. Then she grabs Chris and she just says, lick me, and like forces Chris's head to her down below area, which is now bloody from her doing what she just did with the crucifix. So Chris's face comes away and is like covered in blood. And then Reagan slaps the fuck out of Chris to the point where Chris goes flying, and she falls and hits her head, and she screams this like gut-wrenching, blood-curdling scream. And yet again, this is one of the many injuries that happened on the set of this movie, because similarly to Linda Blair, Ellen Burstyn also suffered a spinal injury from this moment. And the scream that you hear and the scream that you see is her actual scream of pain. What happened was, she was also hooked up to this harness, right? And when she gets slapped, she did her own stunts in this movie, and whoever was in charge of the harness was supposed to yank it. And they did the scene first, and they yanked the harness, and William Friedkin was like, nah, not hard enough. You got to do it harder. Like, he really wanted people to fucking suffer on the set of this movie. So they do the scene a second time, and this time the dude really yanks it. But this time he goes too far with it, and he yanks it to the point where Chris or Ellen Burstyn smacks her head on the wall, and again, she suffered an actual spinal injury. Anyway, I digress. So continue on. There's like a dresser that now starts moving towards Chris, and it's like about to crush her. And this is the moment where we see the head spin, or at least a half head spin at this point, because Reagan is like, her back is facing Chris, and all of a sudden her head is facing Chris. So her back is facing her, and her head completely turns halfway and looks at Chris. And in that demonic guttural voice, she just goes, "Do you know what she did? Your cunting daughter." Now, this is supposed to be a reference to Burke Dennings, because this is how Burke Dennings was found, with his head like twisted all the way back. And that's what she's talking about. Like, did you know what she did? Your daughter, because obviously Reagan, being possessed, is the one that killed Burke Dennings, which Chris is kind of like come to understand at this point, and we as an audience have come to understand as well. Now, I'm going to talk about this at the end, but I really can't wait to talk about the voice that's coming out of Reagan, because it's a woman. Yeah, that's a woman, baby. And I know it's probably difficult to believe, but there is zero editing, zero effect to that. That is a woman making that voice, and we'll get to it, because this woman went through fucking hell to give you that voice. So then we get the next scene, and we see Chris, and she's got glasses on, she's got a scarf on, she's again obviously completely distraught, and this time she's approached by Father Karras, and obviously we can tell that she called for Karras because she's expecting him. They sit down, they're having a conversation, and Chris is like, "How did a shrink get to be a priest?" And he's like, "Actually, it was the other way around. So like, he became a priest first and then kind of got the psychiatric training." And then Chris just drops her question. She goes, how do I go about getting an exorcism?" And he's like, "You can't. You have to like travel back to the 1600s, like basically telling her like it doesn't happen anymore. I've never met a priest who has performed one. It's kind of an outdated thing. The Catholic Church doesn't really approve them." And then Chris starts crying, and she's like, "It's very probable that somebody very close to me is possessed," and starts crying, saying, "It's my little girl, she's possessed." And Karras tries to explain like exorcism can actually make things worse, and like the church has to do a full investigation. The approval is rarely given. But at this point, Chris is so helpless. She's like, "God, will somebody help me?" And Father Karras, you can tell, kind of like takes pity on her and ends up going to the house. So he goes with Chris to the house to see Reagan. So Chris brings Karras up to the room, and they see Carl outside, which like, good for these people, like the Carl and Sharon and the maid, because like, I would have been the fuck out of here so fast. Like, I'm quitting my fucking job on the spot. Goodbye. But Carl's outside the room, and he just says, "It wants no straps," which like, to me is so chilling, because he doesn't say he or she, "It wants no straps." But regardless, Father Karras goes in, and now we see Reagan tied to the bed, and we see her looking real demonic now. Okay, so this is no longer a little girl. This is no longer Reagan. This is a straight up fucking demon. She's got vomit all over her shirt. It's like this like green thick vomit. And the demon voice comes through and says, like, "Kindly loosen these straps." And Karras is like, "I can't do that, Reagan." And it goes, "I'm not Reagan." And Karras tries to introduce himself. He's like, "I'm Damian Karras." And Reagan goes, "And I'm the devil. Now kindly undo these straps." And Karras is kind of fucking around, and he's like, "Well, if you're the devil, then why can't you do it yourself?" And this is one of the most iconic lines, because Reagan goes, "That's much too vulgar a display of power, Karras." Karras goes on to ask, "Where's Reagan?" And Reagan says, "In here with us. Your mother's in here too, Karras." If I was Karras, I would be absolutely fucking shook, but it seems like he's kind of chill about it. And he's like, "Oh yeah, if that's the case, then what is my mother's maiden name?" And the demon can't answer, and clearly gets angry, because then just straight up vomits on Karras. Doesn't answer, just projectile vomits directly in his face. Fun fact about this scene. So the vomit actually was supposed to hit the actor who plays Karras in the chest, but the tube that it was coming out of malfunctioned, and it hit him directly in the eyes and the mouth. So like, his disgust in that scene is 100% real, because it was not supposed to get in his face and in his eyes and in his goddamn mouth like that. If you know anything about this movie, you also probably know the fun fact that the vomit in this movie is actually pea soup. It's just a concoction using pea soup. It wasn't Campbell's though, because they tried Campbell's, but they didn't like the like consistency of it. So it's actually Anderson's brand pea soup. Now, apparently Linda Blair at this age hated vegetables so much that when this had to be in her mouth, she actually did vomit from it, because she hated the taste of it so much. So that happens. And then we cut to Father Karras and Chris in the basement. She's like washing his clothes for him, whatever. She's folding up his sweater. And he just says to her, like, I can't do it. I need evidence, like her speaking a different language or something. And they're talking about exorcism. And Father Karras is like, honestly, I don't even know what else the requirements are. Like, nobody does this. Like, he's saying to Chris, you probably know more about exorcism than any like average priest does. Like, nobody does this anymore. And he says to Chris, like, she says that she's the devil himself. I think that she's psychotic. And Chris is like, be so fucking for real right now. That thing upstairs is not my daughter. Like, tell me you know for a fact that exorcism won't do any good. And he can't, because he doesn't really know. And then he asks Chris, did Reagan know that my mom died? And Chris says, no, why? And he's like, it's not important. Good night. And obviously he's asking because we know that Reagan said, like, your mother's in here with us, Karras, which how would she say, like, how would she know she was dead? Then we see Detective Kinderman as Karras is leaving, kind of watching him. And then we see Karras go back to whatever you want to call it, the monastery or wherever he stays, the university. And he's listening to a recording of Reagan. But this is when Reagan was like normal Reagan. Like, it's like a phone call or like a recording to her father. And it's like just a completely different person. And obviously he can see that. So Father Karras goes back, I'm assuming the next day, it's hard to tell, but he walks in on Reagan. And this is where we get the other very iconic line from this movie, because he walks in and Reagan just goes, what an excellent day for an exorcism. And Father Karras is like, oh, you want an exorcism? Wouldn't that drive you out of Reagan? And it's like, no, it would bring us closer together. You and Reagan, you and us, to Karras. And then before Karras even has a moment to reply, the drawer that he's sitting next to on the nightstand opens. And he closes it and he looks at the demon and he's like, do it again. And the demon just goes, in time. And then all of a sudden, it starts speaking Latin. But only very briefly, because then Father Karras is like, oh, you speak Latin? And then it changes to French and says a few words in French, whatever. And Karras is like, how long do you plan on staying in Reagan? And the demon goes, until she rots and lies stinking in the earth. And then Karras takes out what he says is holy water and starts like throwing it on the demon, which starts writhing and screaming. It burns, it burns. And then the demon starts speaking again, but this time it's not in a different language. It just seems to be like gibberish. It's really no discernible language, no discernible words are coming out of its mouth. Then Karras checks in with Chris again and asks this time, like, where's her father? To which Chris says he's in Europe. And Karras is like, you should tell him what's happening here. Chris kind of like brushes that off. And then Father Karras goes on to explain that when he went to go throw the holy water on her, it wasn't actually holy water, it's tap water. And he's like, this isn't going to support our case for a possession, because like the demon was freaking out at tap water. That makes it seem, you know, pretty much like Reagan's faking to be possessed and thought this was holy water and was like freaking out, pretending to freak out. And then Chris just looks at Father Karras and was like, she killed Burke Dennings. So she drops that fucking bomb. And she goes on to explain that Reagan pushed Burke Dennings out her window and that's how he died. She just knows it. So then we cut to Karras once again listening to the tapes from that day, and he's listening to it with a colleague, and he's like asking, like, is this any sort of language that you know, talking about the gibberish that Reagan was speaking towards the end? And the colleague's like, yeah, it's English. And Karras is like, what the fuck are you talking about, bro? And he's like, yeah, it's English in reverse, play it in reverse. And Karras indeed does play it in reverse, and it surely is English in reverse. And he gets multiple voices on this recording saying, fear the priest, Marin, Marin. So as he's listening to this and he hears that what the demon said, the phone rings, and obviously it startles him because he just heard this coming out of Reagan's mouth. And the next thing we see is him running to Reagan's, and it's Sharon who answers the door and is like, I don't want Chris to see this. And she takes Karras up to Reagan's room, puts on a coat because again, it's freezing in there. They can see their breaths and whatnot. And they go in and Sharon lifts up Reagan's shirt, and we can see the words, help me, forming as if it's being scratched from like the inside of her on her stomach. So now Karras is convinced that he has enough evidence. So he ends up bringing the evidence to the whatever the fuck you want to call it, the bishop. He uses a different word. I don't know. But he tells this person, I would want to do the exorcism myself. And the dude's like, okay, well, let's see who else is around, because like obviously it's going to take more than one person. And then this individual drops the name Lancaster Marin. And he's talking to another like bishop or whoever. And he's like, wasn't he in Iraq? And he's like, no, he just came back like 3 or 4 months ago. And one of them is like, don't you think he's too old? And they're like, no, he had an experience. He's like experienced doing exorcisms 10 to 12 years ago. He did an exorcism in Africa and this lasted months and it damn near killed him. So like, if anything, this is our guy. Like, he knows what he's doing. And now the next scene is where we get the iconic shot that is fucking known around the world, man. Like, this is the shot that's on the cover of the DVD. I have a shirt with this fucking shot on it. We see a cab pull up to the McNeil residence and out of it steps Father Marin, and he's wearing this hat and he's standing under a street light and he kind of just looks up and we see his silhouette and there's fog and it's just so beautiful and so iconic. What a shot. So Father Marin enters the house and this is where he meets Karis, and we can hear Reagan screaming from upstairs and he tells Karis, like, I need you to go to the monastery and get some things for me. So Karis does it. Karis comes back and Father Marin's telling him, like, we'll need to avoid conversations. Just remember that he's a liar. He will mix lies with the truth and the attack is going to be psychological. Like, don't fucking listen to a word it says. Now, Karis, you can tell, isn't even fully convinced that Reagan is possessed, because now he tries to tell Father Marin, like, oh, well, I've pinpointed three different personalities, and Father Marin just looks at him and just says, there's only one. Like, basically the priestly way of telling him, shut the fuck up. Now, little thing about Father Marin here, he's played by Max von Sydow, which iconic actor, just passed away probably within the last few years. Now, he looks old in this movie, and even like earlier when they said, oh, don't you think he's too old? Because he looks like he's at least in like his 60s or 70s. He was only like in his early 40s, Max von Sydow was, while filming this movie. I think like 42 or 44. He was in his early 40s. They did so well with the makeup on him in this movie that he actually had trouble getting roles after this, because people who saw him in this movie thought he was older, like older for the roles that he was auditioning for, but he wasn't. Anyway, so this is where Father Marin goes in and initially meets the demon, and they go in, they start praying, and this is where Reagan just throws these absolute vulgar obscenities at the priests, and she starts with greeting him by saying, stick your cock up her ass, you worthless cocksucker. Very nice, kind way to greet somebody. So that's beautiful. Mind you, it's also said that Max von Sydow is a very like gentlemanly man, a very proper man. And hearing Reagan or Linda Blair say these things, the first time he actually heard her say these things, he forgot his lines. He was so stunned to hear a child speak that way that he was like his flabbers were fucking gasted, bitch. Like, he was fucking taken aback. Again, professional actor, crazy repertoire this man had, and forgot his lines. And again, I'll get to this later because obviously there was a voiceover effect to get the demon voice, but Linda Blair was actually saying these lines, you know, and they ended up just get like matching the voice to her lips moving. But Linda Blair was saying these lines during the actual filming, and it was just a voiceover what happened after. So Reagan says that and then just spits directly in Marin's face, and it's not even normal spit, it's kind of like just bile, it's the green shit again, it's fucking gross. And Father Marin and Father Karis start praying because that's what they do during an exorcism. And as they start doing that, Reagan looks at Father Karis and says, your mother sucks cocks in hell, you faithless slime. Honestly, like, the insults that come out in this movie are fucking impeccable. You faithless slime. Love it. They ignore her. They continue to pray. And then the bed once again starts violently shaking. And they keep praying. They're ignoring it. And now it's violently shaking to the point where it actually starts fucking levitating. Okay. And it stuns Karis so much that he initially forgets to read the reply that he's supposed to read to Father Marin's prayer. And it's at this point where we once again get that flash of the white Pazuzu demon face. Okay. Very briefly, like blink and you'll miss it type thing. And then we get a shot of Reagan. She just has vomit like pouring out of her mouth. It's pouring onto Father Marin's, like, I don't know what they call those things, the little thin strip of fabric they have around their neck. His is like purple, so vomit all over it. So Karis takes it and goes to like wash it off in the sink. As he's doing that, the windows are opening and closing, shit's flying around by itself, and the demon is just laughing, like this like demonic creepy ass fucking laugh. And now Father Marin continues to pray and he says, I cast you out, unclean spirit. And the demon says, shove it up your ass. So this is going very well. They continue praying, and it's at this point where we get the full 180 head spin, and Reagan's just sitting there, demonic voice, like fucking fog coming out of her mouth because it's so cold, and just completely 180 turns all the fucking way around. And it's at this point the demon looks at Karis and says, you killed your mother, you left her alone to die. So now, like, when Meryn said, like, the whole, like, the attack is going to be psychological, this is what he fucking meant, because now it's coming at Karis for, like, the one thing that bothers him. And now the demon, like, flops back on the bed and the eyes roll to the back of the head. Now we see complete whites and the restraints just completely rip off out of restraints, and it starts levitating, just slowly floats up. And this is the other iconic moment or line of this movie: the power of Christ compels you. So Father Meryn and Father Karis jointly in unison repeatedly say, the power of Christ compels you, as Father Meryn is throwing holy water on the demon. And now we see one shot when the holy water gets thrown, it like cuts the demon's skin. So now we can see that the holy water actually is affecting it. And they end up saying the power of Christ compels you 14 times in unison. 14. So as they're doing this, they continue to throw the holy water, and eventually Reagan lowers down slowly, and as she gets back down on the bed, Father Karis sits down and goes to restrain her. However, she pops up behind Karis and like hits him over the head and sends him flying. Now both priests get thrown back by an unseen force, and they look up at Reagan, and she's like kneeling on the bed at this point. She's no longer restrained. And we see this like really creepy shot, because it's like the silhouette of Reagan, and there's light coming from behind her. And behind her, we see Father Meryn see the statue that he saw in Iraq. Like, we very clearly see that it's the statue, and Father Meryn's looking at it. And this, again, is just like the hallucinations that the demons are making them have, right? So obviously we can tell that like Father Meryn's the only one that's seeing this. And after this, the demon lies back down on the bed, and they tie her back up, and Father Meryn says to Father Karis, like, we all need to rest for a bit, like, we need to take a break. And we see them outside of the room, and they're kind of talking and processing, and Father Karis is like, this just doesn't make sense, like, talking about why would this take a child, you know, like, why would this take an innocent child? And Father Meryn says the point is to make us despair. Like, it wants us to see ourselves as animals, you know, because we're like binding this child to a bed. Father Meryn goes into the bathroom. He's taking these pills that we saw him taking in the beginning too. And once again, he's shaking. Obviously, this whole thing is shaking him up, which, like, do you fucking blame the guy? Now, at this point, Father Karis goes back into the room, and he looks at the bed, and he sees this very brief flash of his mother sitting on the bed. So once again, now he's hallucinating. He has this vision of his mother sitting on the bed, and all of a sudden the demon starts speaking, but instead of the creepy demon voice, it's his mother's voice saying, why'd you do this to me, Demi? Why? I'm afraid. And it's like really fucking sad, because Karis is like, you're not my mother. And it keeps talking, and eventually he screams, you're not my mother. And Meryn obviously can see that he's distraught and that the demon is getting to him. So he tells Father Karis to get out. So Karis leaves, and Meryn continues to pray. And we see Karis then talking to Chris, and Chris is just like, is she going to die up there? Like, be for real with me right now, Karis. Is she going to die up there? And Karis just looks at her and says, no. And it's almost at that point where Karis, like, once again gets the motivation to go back in there, because he's like, I'm not going to let this girl die. And he goes back in the room. However, when he goes back in the room, he finds Father Meryn laying lifeless on the bed. Okay. Flops him over, and he's dead. Father Meryn is fucking dead. We don't know how he died. We never find out how he died, but all we know is that he is dead. And we pan over to Reagan, or the demon, and we see her sitting on the bed, kind of staring like lifelessly. And then all of a sudden we see her start laughing. This maniacal, demonic laugh. At this point, Father Karis has had enough, because he attacks Reagan / the demon and just starts screaming, take me, come into me, take me. And now he's got Reagan on the floor, like choking her. And all of a sudden, there's this moment, and we see this switch. And this whole time, the demon's eyes and Reagan have been like glowing green, like this really creepy glowing green. And all of a sudden, we see Father Karis's eyes go green. And then we hear Reagan's normal little girl voice come out of her, and she's crying. Father Karis stands up, and obviously we see that he's now the one possessed, because we see again that glow in his eyes. And he looks down at Reagan, and we get like a POV shot, and he like takes his hands and he starts to go strangle Reagan. But he like snaps out of it, and we see the green leave his eyes, and he returns to himself. And when he returns to himself, he proceeds to throw himself out Reagan's window down the same set of stairs that Burke Dennings flew down and broke his neck and died on. And we see him throw himself out the window and go flying down that set of stairs. So obviously Chris hears the commotion, and she comes running coming in and we hear Reagan and we see her crying in the corner and she's crying out for her mother. But again, she now has Reagan's little girl voice, not this fucking demonic voice. So Karis goes flying out the window. Obviously, that brings attention and like the police start coming and everything. And Father Dyer, who we've seen throughout this movie, who, by the way, is a real priest. His name is William O'Malley, the actor who played him. And he's a real priest and was for like his whole life. And he ends up going up to Karis's like dying body. Karis didn't die immediately, and he holds his hand and he gives him his last rites and he absolves him of his sins. A little fun fact here, and this again goes to the controversial ways that William Friedkin acted on the set of his movies and what he did to get genuine reactions out of the actors, because in this scene, as William O'Malley is going up to a dying Father Karis, right before he yelled cut, it's reported that Friedkin looked at him and just bitch slapped him across the face. Just absolutely like fucking smacked the shit out of this guy. And it was like, go ahead. And like yelled action. So when he goes up to Karis and he's like visibly shaken, it's because he just got bitch slapped by a full grown man and he was not expecting it. Once again, controversial. It was the 70s. However, William Friedkin had a very specific way of working that elicited exactly the responses and the reactions that he wanted. So say what you will, but I mean, he had a point. So obviously that happens and Father Karis dies, and he dies for Reagan, and with him he takes the unclean spirit or the demon or whatever you want to call it. And now we see our final scenes, and we see Chris packing up the house. They're obviously getting their stuff, they're leaving, the movie's done, whatever. We don't even know if they ended up finishing the movie. I can't imagine they did. And then Sharon gives Chris this coin or medallion, and it's the same one we've been seeing from the beginning, and she says, I found this in her room. And Chris takes it, and her and Sharon hug. They're saying goodbye. And Reagan and Chris leave. They're packing the car. And as they're going to get in the car, they see Father Dyer. And Chris introduces Reagan to Father Dyer because she says to Father Dyer that Reagan doesn't remember anything. She doesn't remember anything about the possession. She doesn't remember any of the priests. And she introduces her to Father Dyer, and Reagan just looks at him and hugs him. So it's almost like she does remember something. Like she sees that he's a priest and she hugs him because she remembers that like a priest saved her life. So she's like associating the two. And they get in the car, and before they drive away, Chris goes to give Father Dyer the necklace or the medallion. And he's like, no, I think you should keep this, and gives it back to her. So she keeps it and the two of them drive away. Then the final scene we get is Father Dyer walking away. He looks at the stairs where obviously Burke Dennings and Father Karis perished on. And he looks up and sees the window that Karis flew out of is now boarded up, and he walks away and he sees Lieutenant or Detective Kinderman. And Kinderman goes up to him and he says exactly what he said to Father Karis earlier. He's like, you go to films? And he's like, oh, there's this film playing. Father Dyer says, who's in it? And Kinderman's explaining, and Dyer goes, I've seen it. And Kinderman just goes, another one, like kind of like joking, like, oh, first Father Karis, now you. And the two of them walk away, and we get the iconic sound of Tubular Bells as the credits roll. And that's it, baby. That's the movie. And I would just like to point out the fact that this movie has a 2-hour runtime. 2 hours and 2 minutes, I think, to be exact. And the possession scene that is like so traumatizing and like literally destroyed a whole generation of people only lasts for 9 minutes. So this movie is almost like a Jaws thing, you know, like you only see the shark for 4 minutes. So it seems like it's in the whole movie because like that's the part that's terrifying. And it's the same thing with The Exorcist, I think. Like we really feel like that scene is the whole movie. You're like, I watched a 2-hour movie and only 9 minutes of it was the actual exorcism. Like, what the fuck actually happened in between, you know? But yeah, 9 minutes, that's it. Now, as we discussed, William Friedkin obviously was kind of a controversial director and did some like kind of sketchy shit to get genuine reactions from the actors on his set. And in addition to slapping people, another thing that he did was fired a fucking gun on the set. And Jason Miller, who played Father Karis, actually like got into a pretty heated verbal altercation with Friedkin because he fired a gun directly next to his ear to get like a genuine authentic reaction from it. And Jason Miller tried to be like, I'm a fucking actor, I don't need a gun to act surprised or to act like I'm scared. Like I could do that without you firing a fucking gun directly near my ear, thank you. But it is said that the only person that he did warn about firing the gun on set was Linda Blair, So at least that was kind of him. Now, I talk a lot about this movie, again, like I said, in my Cursed Films episode, because this is often one of the movies that people look at and say is a cursed film, because there's a lot of different deaths that are associated with this movie. A few different actors that worked on it died not long after the movie was completed or during the production. Some family members, like Linda Blair's grandfather, Max von Sydow's brother, I think it was, passed away during this. But in reality, I think this movie was just so controversial that people like just wanted to attribute anything bad to it. Billy Graham came out and was like, you know, the devil, there's like a demon hidden in the reels of this movie, and if you watch it, you're inviting the devil in, blah, blah, blah. Like, I think he was just trying to turn people off from watching this because it was so like anti-church, anti-Christ. And it was actually to the point where the studio had to hire bodyguards for Linda Blair, and they hired them for 6 months after the film's release because she was literally getting death threats from people. A fucking 13-year-old girl, 14, she turned on the set of this movie, was getting death threats from people. And now if you watch the Cursed Films episode on Shudder, Linda Blair is in this episode, obviously now as an adult, and she's talking about it, and she's like, it's interesting though, because The Omen came out not like far from this, right? The Omen was 1976, a few years later. And like the little boy who played Damien didn't get death threats like I did. So like, what the fuck was that about? And obviously it's because she was a little girl, and little girls aren't supposed to say these vulgar, terrible things. It's fucking sacrilegious or whatever. But anyway, it's awful. And again, she went through a lot of shit for this. And I think the one thing that's really sweet is, again, like how close her and Ellen Burstyn seem to have become on the set of this movie. Like I said, like there's that moment where Linda's injured and Ellen's the one that runs for her, right? And it turns out, I read this little fun fact once, that Ellen had this bracelet that she wore during the filming, and you can actually see Chris wearing it during the movie. And after the movie wrapped production, she actually gave this to Linda Blair because it was like something to remember her by and like remember the movie by. And years later, when Linda was an adult, her and Ellen ran into each other on a plane. They were going to the same place and they happened to be on the same plane. And when they ran into each other, Linda was wearing the bracelet. All those years later, as a full-ass adult, she was wearing the bracelet that Ellen gave her. So I think that's just such a heartwarming little story. Now let's talk about the voice of the demon, because I think this is actually one of the greatest performances in this movie, and it's something that's very much overlooked because she doesn't actually obviously have any physical screen time. We never see her face, but she is indeed the terrifying voice behind Pazuzu, or the demon. So William Friedkin obviously knew that the voice of the demon, it was never going to be able to come from Linda Blair. She was never going to be able to provide such like a guttural and menacing voice that he wanted. So initially he was actually going to like create one, like electronically use Linda's voice and then put effects over it, but it just simply didn't work. He said it just still sounded like a little girl trying to sound like a grown man. And then he also got a friend of his named Ken Nordine to record some like voiceovers for the movie, and he said that he just sounded like a grown man trying to sound like a little girl. So either way, it was not working. Like, he couldn't get it right. And then he heard Orson Welles, another obviously iconic director, not in the horror genre but elsewhere. Orson Welles once called a woman the greatest voice actress ever, and this woman was somebody named Mercedes McCambridge. Now, she had already had an extensive career. Most of it was spent in television and radio, so she was mostly a voice actress, okay? She had actually already won an Oscar. I believe it was for Best Supporting Actress. She had worked alongside, like, Elizabeth Taylor, Joan Crawford, Janet Leigh, like a lot of like really legendary actresses of the time. So she already had a pretty impressive resume. But if you hear her regular voice, it sounds nothing like a demon. It sounds nothing like a guttural, raspy man. It sounds like a woman. But William Friedkin was like, you know what? Orson Welles says that she's the best voice actress of our generation, or ever, really, so let's try it out. So he approached Mercedes McCambridge, he being Friedkin, and offered her the role. And she ended up going into detail telling him how she was actually a recovering alcoholic. She had not had a drink in years, and she had also actually smoked for 30 years, okay? To get the right voice for this movie, it was her idea. She insisted on breaking her sobriety. She literally started like chugging whiskey, okay? Not even just drinking casually. This bitch was fucking chugging straight whiskey. And on top of that, she insisted on swallowing raw eggs and chain smoking. Okay. And this was all with the intention of creating this like strained, guttural voice that was needed for the demon. Now, the alcohol part, obviously, like she knew that that would strain her voice more, but she also wanted to create this like crazed state of mind. And she knew that especially from being like a recovering alcoholic, the alcohol was going to put her in that mindset. This woman literally risked her sobriety for this performance. Because she was giving up her sobriety and because she was also a religious woman, she actually required that her priest be present on set while she was recording. And from what I read, it was actually also her idea that when she was recording, she be restrained and tightly bound to a chair by the neck and by the wrist, because she wanted to literally sound like she was struggling. She wanted to sound restrained. She wanted it to sound unnatural. Because of what she was putting herself through, William Friedkin said in a memoir that he wrote how Mercedes would need to take breaks for like an hour in between takes, like just crying, being consoled by the priests. I remember, I highly recommend if you guys are interested in learning more, there is a documentary called Leap of Faith on Shudder. And they talk a lot, well, it's William Friedkin in this documentary. He's talking a lot about behind the scenes and he talks about Mercedes and says that like there were times and there were scenes where like they would unrestrain him from the chair and she would just collapse into like her priest's arms because she was just so exhausted by what she just put herself through. Like, I can't even imagine the strain that you're putting on your body and your vocal cords. Like, this poor woman. Well, Friedkin, mind you, is the guy who's like slapping people across the face and firing guns on set, right? However, he admits that Mercedes is the one person who fucking terrified him, because he's like, her performance, like the extremes that she decided to put herself through and like the authenticity of it and just like the rage that she had and like the mindset she put herself in, he was fucking terrified of this woman. So the voice that we get is the voice of Mercedes McCambridge. Again, there is no distorting. That is dead ass her voice, with the exception of when the voice is, when the demon is leaving Reagan and going into Father Karras, because the sounds that are coming out at that point, and I'm sorry, this might be disturbing for animal lovers here, but the sounds that are coming out of the demon when it is going into, when it is leaving Reagan and going into Karras, is the real life sound of pigs being herded for slaughter. That's kind of like symbolic of what happens, you know? So it's literally like the demon is going into Karras just to be killed. But regardless, Mercedes McCambridge is a fucking queen, and like she was so dedicated to this role. However, there was some controversy about it because there's like, it's kind of like a whole he said, she said. I honestly don't think we'll ever know the real story, but Friedkin claims that at the beginning of this, she didn't want screen credit. Mercedes did not want screen credit for the voice because she wanted people to believe that this voice was actually coming from this little girl. Like, she wanted it to add to like the allure and the terror of this movie. But eventually, when the movie took off in the way that it did, Mercedes actually ended up suing the studio over it. And she ended up, now she does have credit on the film, but she did not originally. Now, when she talks about this, she talks about how she had to have her priest on set, obviously because of what she was putting herself through, but also because, and I quote, speaking those vile blaspheming words was agony for me, end quote. Because again, she was very religious, she was a devout Catholic, and she has to say things like, your mother sucks cocks in hell. And again, she says that she never said that she didn't want credit on the movie, whatever. It's a whole he said, she said. I don't know who was right, but regardless, she ended up getting credit. And I wish more people knew her story, because again, what she put herself through for this movie is unreal and just speaks to what a great actress she is, I believe. Obviously, as we know, I'm sure everybody's heard stories of people passing out, throwing up during this movie. Like I said, there's reports that one theater reported that most of the people passing out were happening during the needle scene, when they put the needle in Reagan's throat and the blood's all spurting out. But there were so many people so badly affected by this movie that at a lot of theaters, they already set up paramedics at screenings because they were just expecting people to faint and to just go into absolute hysterics because it was happening across the country. Speaking of across the country, another little fun fact is that the movie was released in the UK. However, they actually banned it because so many town councils were like so offended by it and just so horrified by it. So this led to what they call exorcist bus trips, where these travel companies would organize buses to take groups of people to nearby towns where the film was showing, because like their town banned it. So they would go to they would have to go to like a neighboring town to go see it. Honestly, this movie really did take the world by storm. Like, I remember watching, if you YouTube it, you'll find it, like people being interviewed outside the movie theater. And like one guy's like, I wasn't even really scared. You know, I kind of just passed out. I don't really know what happened. Like, bitch, you were scared and you can fucking admit it. It's fine. But people, we've never had a movie like this and we'll never have one again. You will never have a movie where people are passing out in the theater. And again, I know it's a different time and we're more desensitized now, but like we will never have this again. I would give up a limb to have been there and seen this in the theater when it came out in 1973. When you hear like parents or grandparents talking about how they were alive and how they saw it in the theater, God, I would give anything to have been there and to have been in that situation. I fucking wish. Like, they were literally witnessing history. Now, again, I truly do believe this to be the most iconic film ever created. However, it was based on a very iconic book. And to me personally, the book is actually scarier than this movie. And I say that wholeheartedly, and I've heard other people say that as well. This is the only book I've ever read where I was so terrified I had to turn all the lights on in my apartment. Like, I actually was scared reading this book. For some reason, it just hit me in a way that a book never has. Mind you, I read this for the first time after seeing this movie probably 100 times already in my life. So like I was expecting, like I knew what was coming in the book, but for some reason it just affected me in such a deep way I was not prepared for. What some people might not know, however, is that this book, which came out in 1971, actually was inspired by a true story. And I'll leave you with a brief account of that true story, because what happened was in the late 1940s, there was a young boy. He was 14 years old and he was allegedly the victim of demonic possession. And subsequently, he had an exorcism performed on him, and the events of this exorcism are what inspired William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist novel in 1971. So originally they used to call this kid Roland Doe because, again, he was a child at the time. They didn't want to disclose his real identity. But eventually it came out in 2021 that this individual's real name was Ronald Edwin Hunkler. And this was his identity was outed after he already passed away. He passed away in 2020. I think he was like 85 or something. And in 2021, it was revealed who this person was, his real identity. The events of his life and exorcism aren't nearly as crazy as the events of The Exorcist. But what really inspired the book is the origin of his alleged exorcism. Because this individual, Ronald, Roland, whatever you want to refer to him as, he was referred to Roland Doe for most of the time. So his aunt, whose name was Aunt Harriet, or I think they called her Aunt Tilly, was a spiritualist and introduced Roland to Ouija boards. And they started playing with Ouija boards because he took a fondness to them. After Aunt Harriet died, the family reported that they were experiencing some strange noises. Furniture started moving around. They reported that like vases were flying or levitating, but it was really only when Roland was nearby them. The family's like started getting a little freaked out, and they turned to their pastor, whose name was Luther Schultz, for help. And he kind of observed Roland, and he like was supporting his claims. He reported that like Roland's bed was rattling when he was laying down on it, and like the floor was like all fucked up from furniture sliding around on it. And at one point, like a chair threw him out of it. So this specific individual like was backing up the claims that this kid was possessed. And Roland's mother thought that like all these issues were related to his aunt passing away, because she was the one that showed him how to communicate with spirits and all that. And that's what they thought. And it's reported, this was actually William Friedkin that said this, I'll just quote it. He said, the family was Lutheran and they went through all the stages you see in the film. They went to doctors, clinics, and finally went back to their own pastor in the Lutheran church, who recommended they see a priest. So eventually the family went to a Jesuit priest, whose name was William Boder. And he ended up performing 20 exorcism rituals on Roland over a span of 3 months. And this priest's diary kind of describes the exorcisms. And he says that Roland entered a trance-like state, during the exorcisms and that there were more than a dozen witnesses that could like corroborate this and back this up. And they make a bunch of claims of things that happened during the exorcism. So like they're saying that the mattress was shaking. They are saying that there were like words that ended up being scratched into Roland's rib cage. So kind of similar to when the "help me" is scratched into Reagan in the movie. At one point, Roland was admitted to a hospital. And during like this fit of rage, he ended up actually breaking a priest's nose, or so it's reported. Now it's said that in all of these exorcisms, Roland would like break into like violent tantrums. He would scream, he would curse, and he would like repeat Latin phrases. However, they're like, you know, people who counter this are like, well, these, it was just a few Latin phrases and he could have easily heard these and just remembered them. Regardless, the priest who performed these 20 exorcisms, like I said, kept a diary and like a journal of the events. And this diary is actually what William Peter Blatty based his horror novel on. So that is what we see in the book The Exorcist. Now later on, this guy actually ended up growing up to be pretty successful. He worked at NASA for like 40 years before he passed away. Again, in 2020, he was like 85. And he had a friend that told, this is all from the National Post, I'm getting this information from, by the way. So he had a friend that told the Post that he actually like later admitted that he was never actually possessed and he was making it all up. And he said, quote, "I was just a bad boy," end quote. However, I will leave you with this. It's a weird little anecdote. Apparently, as Hunkler was dying, that was his real name. As Hunkler was dying, a Catholic priest arrived at his door to perform last rites. And his friend, whoever this person is that spoke to the Post, was like, "I never called a priest." She was the person with him. And she says, and I quote, "I have no idea how the father knew to come, but he got Ron to heaven. Ron's in heaven and he's with God now," end quote. Again, this is all alleged. This is probably all hearsay. Like, who's to say if this really happened? Who's to say if this companion actually even knew this guy? But if that's the case and this guy was dying and a priest just showed up, that's some fucking scary shit to me. So I don't know. What do you think? But there you have it. There's The Exorcist, what I believe to be one of the greatest, if not the greatest and most iconic horror film ever made. And also what I firmly believe to be the scariest horror film ever made. We'll never have anything like this again. And again, I just wish I was alive during this time to experience the absolute mass hysteria that it caused, because I have been chasing that high ever since, you know, like I wish I lived in a generation where we could get something like that. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope it made you appreciate The Exorcist if you didn't already. And I hope it makes some of you go watch it if you haven't already, or watch it again if you only watched it once a long time ago. But as always, follow me on TikTok and Instagram. It's horror_chronicles. You guys know where to find me. I post especially on TikTok pretty much every day. So until next time, watch more horror movies and stay spooky, my friends.